After these two good speeches already on the subject of Revelation, I feel that I have little or nothing to do. I do appreciate your asking me to come and talk on this theme, though when Brother Gary called me on the phone talking about it, I just know that he said I was to talk about the premillennial views in the book of Revelation. And then when I got the notice that I was talking about the signs and the symbols, I didn't know which one I was to do. Now then, just now, Brother Royce has suggested that he's going to leave it to me to wade in. There's one thing he doesn't know. He doesn't know that I've got a plank out in the water just 2 inches under. And that's all. That's as deep as I'm going. So far as the signs and the symbols are concerned, I'm sure about a few of them, because the Lord explains them. And the rest of them sometimes is a very poor guess. But there is value in studying the signs and symbols. There is value in studying the book, as these two brethren have already pointed out. So, if you don't know the significance or the meaning of some sign or some symbol in the book, don't cast it aside. If you do, you'll find yourself casting aside nearly all the rest of the New Testament or of the Bible, so far as that's concerned. For much of it is written in figurative speech, or signs and symbols, which are figures. I first want to talk about some of the terms used. Now, the two signs and symbols have been mentioned in the subject, but I'm going first to another term that is used in the book itself, and that is the word vision. How is the word vision used in the Bible, or in the book of Revelation? For instance, if you turn to chapter 9, you will find the word vision used concerning some horsemen. Long about verse 17. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them. Now, here he talks about a multitude of horses, 10 times 10,000, and twice that many. I haven't stopped to figure that up yet, just how many that is, but that's some of the signs, some of the symbolic language that he uses when he gives such a number as that. And he says that that was a vision. The word vision literally means what is used in the text oftentimes as I saw. I saw this, and I saw that. And then he says, this is what it was in the vision. This word is used in Acts 2:17, quoted from Joel chapter 2, when he talked about some would dream dreams and some would see visions. He uses that very term. So, in order for us to get a view, I'm about to use another term for the word vision now, but in order to get a view of what is meant in such statements by John, when he says, I saw the vision of the horses, think of Peter's vision of the animals in Acts 10 and verse 17. Now, I'm citing the verse because there the word vision is used. That Peter saw this in a vision. You know, all of the four-footed beasts, clean and unclean, let down in a sheet out of heaven, that Peter saw when he went up on the housetop to pray. Well, now then, the question is, were they literal or was it figurative? Was there a literal four-cornered sheet that would hold all of the four-footed beasts of the earth? One time it took an ark to hold two of each kind. And now then, it's a sheet that holds it in this. We understand that there is figurative language And yet there are people who study the book of Revelation and want to take these things which are seen in vision as literal. I heard some of that done this morning by a fellow that maybe you've heard once in a while, Jimmy Swagger. While I was eating my cereal, and that's what I had now to get here on this morning. While I was eating my cereal, my wife went on and turned the TV on, and while she was looking for something else, I don't know what she was looking for, but anyhow, she came across Jimmy Swagger. And he was talking about somebody, it's your guess as good as mine, somebody who's fixing to come or already is here, who is the man of sin, who is the son of perdition, who is the beast. And the beast is one of those terms used in the book of Revelation. And thus, he's got his idea as just exactly who that is. And some other things about it, but that's about all I heard of the thing. This is figurative language, and we can understand that when he talked in the case of Peter. But it had a meaning. It signified the acceptability of the Gentiles. And when Peter went to the household of Cornelius, he told them that he understood that he was not to consider them unacceptable to receive the gospel. In the 10th chapter of Acts. Or, let's take another case to show us what visions are in Acts 16 and verse 9. It is said that Paul saw a vision, had a vision. It was of a man calling to him to come over into Macedonia and help us. And then the scriptures explains what that vision was, that Paul understood that he was to go preach the gospel to them in Macedonia, that's what it signified. Thus, if you read all that is said in that 17th or in that 9th chapter of Revelation, where I read verse 17 a minute ago, you will find that John's vision of these horses, so many of them, and the horsemen, that really he is describing calamity that comes upon the world. This is what is involved in it. Now, that is what is implied or is meant by the use of the word vision, that it is a figurative thing, has it having an application, and not a literal thing. Then we come to the word sign. It also is used several times in the book, in chapter 12 and verse 1, and a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the white sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, and so on. But it says the sign was seen in heaven. What is a sign? Once again, I refer to you Acts 2 and verse 19. I referred to verse 17 before, but verse 19 says, I will show signs and wonders. That God will show signs and wonders. Now then, let's look at Revelation 1 and verse 1. And you find this expression used. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show unto his servants, even the things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Now there is a connection between this word and the word used in Revelation 12 and 1. The basic word, semino, in the original language, has one form, and I gave the verb form, for signify, and the noun form is sign. A sign signifies. I may use it that way, or I may signify a thing by signs. And thus, the meaning is the same. Where John says that it was signified, then he saw the sign, is what is involved in that term. Now, let's look at another passage or two in other places in the scriptures and see how that is used. John 12, verses 32 and 33. Jesus said, among other things said there, he said, "And I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me." And John the writer said that that was signifying what manner of death he should die. Well, now, that didn't say that he was going to die on the cross, did it? But when he said, "If I be lifted up from the earth, I'll draw all men unto me," was he talking about his going back to heaven when he said that? You might get that impression if you had nothing else said about it. But John said that it was talking about the manner of death that he should die, rather than resurrection. See, there's the explanation of the sign that Jesus gave in these words, a verbal sign that he gave, and then, I say a verbal sign, and then when he was lifted up on the cross, there is the sign fulfilling the manner of death that he should die. So the signs that John sees in this book of Revelation. There's another thing I want to refer to as I talk about this, which is again a figure. The sign is a figure. Or you might call it a figure of speech, if it is speech being engaged in. Revelation 1 again, verses 1 and 3, points out something. He says that he signified it, and then he said, though, that it was for things which must shortly come to pass. Which must shortly come to pass. Another statement is made then in verse 3. He says, "For the time is at hand." Well, that part of the verse. "For the time is at hand." He moves on then into verse 19 and says, "Write therefore the things which thou sawest." There's the visions which thou sawest, and the things which are, and the things which shall come to pass hereafter. They are signs of things which are, and which will come to pass hereafter, is what he says. And as he said earlier, the time is at hand, and it must shortly come to pass. And that just throws it into a complete loop. All of these modern-day fellows who are talking about the things that John saw and saying that that is now to come to pass, 2,000 years, or nearly 2,000 years, after John wrote the letter. There's another word that is used quite often, but before I talk about that word, let me point out why the signs and symbols are given. And that is that they were under Roman persecution. John himself was on the Isle of Patmos, exiled by Roman power. And under that Roman persecution, it is written in such sign, in such symbolic language, in terms used otherwise in the Old and New Testaments that the Christians would understand. And thus, you might say that it's written in code, that those then present would understand. Now then, we may have gone past the point long enough that we don't understand what was then present because he said the things which are. Because we're dependent upon history for that. They had the fact before them. And I may not understand the application of it as they could understand it when John was writing the letter to them. Now then, the other term that I want to talk about, and that is the word symbol. Now, that word symbol is not used in the common text. But it is commonly used as a synonym of the word sign, sometimes of the word vision. And I'm now calling attention to some things in Webster's definition of the word which directly apply under this that we're talking about. First, synonyms. that it is a figure, a type, or a sign. And then in his definition, he says, a visible sign of something invisible. And thus, in that one statement, he has used both of the other terms that I've talked about, sign and vision. And thus, the symbol, a visible sign of something invisible. Then he gives an example of what a symbol is. A lion is a symbol of courage. And thus, we may say, here is the sign given in Revelation, which is a symbolic or a symbol of something. And that's the way the terms are used. let me talk about some other terms now. There's another one that I want to mention, and it isn't in the text either. And that's the word premillennial, or all of its various forms, which is a theory that the Lord will return before a 1,000-year reign on the earth. And it's basically supposed to come from Revelation 20. And that's the connection of this term. There are some two or three words used with this word millennial involved. One is premillennial, which means the Lord's going to come before. That's its meaning. There is the postmillennial, which signifies that the Lord is going to come again after the millennium is over. Then they frequently use the term amillennial, which means no millennium. That some have that idea that there is no millennium. And men would suppose that that's the only ones, those three are the only alternatives you have. But you can believe in a millennium, 1,000 years, and that's all basically the word millennium means, is 1,000 years. You can believe in 1,000 years talked about in the Bible, in the book of Revelation, without believing any one of those three, one of them be disbelieving, but without holding to any one of those three. And then there is another word that has come into use very profusely in the last several years now, and that's the word dispensational. Some folks are dispensationalists. What are they? Well, really, it's just another word used to describe a premillennialist. That's what is involved. Because what is involved in it is they're saying there's going to be another dispensation of God's regime upon the earth after this one in which we live is over, or after the church age, some would describe it, and thus it's still the 1,000 years. And they will call themselves dispensationalists, such as Hal Lindsey and what's the old man who separated from his son out in California? Armstrong, they all had that. Jimmy Swaggart has it. Any number of others have it that you could name. A popular Billy Graham is one of them too, and you can just go on naming characters after characters who think of themselves as dispensationalists. But that is commonly used by such men and of such men as this one that I named, Hal Lindsey, and his great Planet Earth fame, Book of Fame, infamous. But now then, I want to leave that and talk about some of the signs and symbols that are frequently used and in the main are used by these dispensationalists or by the premillennialists that I've talked about. You know, there are two beasts spoken of in Revelation chapter 12 and 13. And these two beasts are different in nature, who are going to rise up. You know, the seven heads and the 10 horns. And then one comes up with 2 horns. That's the next beast. And then there's an image involved in that. And that is that there is the image of the first beast, and that the second beast requires that all men worship the image of the first beast. And right along with that then is 666, the number 666 in there. And that's the kind of thing that Swaggart was referring to this morning as he was talking about the man of sin, the son of perdition, being the beast. He didn't really say which one he was talking about, whether he was talking about beast number one or beast number two, as he said that. I don't know whether he knew that two of them were in there or not. He had just read something about a beast in Revelation, decided it really made a glorious thing for him to talk about, and he had his audience spellbound as he talked about those things. Well, keeping in mind what John has already explained, that it is that which must shortly come to pass that he's writing about, and that he is writing about the things which are and which are to come to pass, then we have something in view. They were then persecuted. John was persecuted on the Isle of Patmos, as I have suggested. Indeed, you can read in that, if you've read any of the history of that period, and know that it does aptly describe the Jewish nation and the Christians and the persecution of the Jewish nation and then of the Christians by the Romans, that it aptly describes just what took place. I've said the Jewish nation and then of the Romans. You understand that there are several views concerning the book of Revelation and its signs and symbols, and one of them is the preterist view, among whom was Foy Wallace, as he brought out his commentary on Revelation, with the idea that all of this took place leading up to and including the destruction of Jerusalem, and that was the final thing that is pictured, that John actually wrote it before the destruction of Jerusalem. There are some difficulties in that. One of the difficulties is that Christians were not being persecuted by the Roman Empire before 70 AD, because you've got Paul included in that number, and he is traveling to Rome on trial, not as a persecution of the Romans, but because of the Jews' animosity, and then the Romans are going to handle it, and he makes his appeal unto the courts in Rome, the courts of Caesar in Rome. And while he's there, that he is granted what we might describe as house arrest, where he could have his own hired dwelling, and people could come to him, which we read about in the latter verses of the book of Acts. And then, this is based upon a few hints in the Bible, that Paul maybe made another journey throughout the Roman Empire during his life. And you're getting us right on up to and maybe through some of 70 AD with all of that. And thus, there is that difficulty that idea will have to deal with, that it all occurred before 70 AD. Some of you may have Brother Foy's book on that. But I think that's one of the major difficulties. Now, he'll have difficulty with a lot of signs and symbols in it, too, as far as that's concerned, and trying to get it all to work in. But that is a major difficulty with that kind of a position, which is known as the preterist position concerning it. You know, there is the historical, which they're using today, that it is going on today, and some other views But this was written for their understanding at that time, I'm emphasizing, and it does describe what they were undergoing right at that time. I don't even try to tell you that that's it, but I'm saying it fitly describes it, what they were undergoing at that time, and the statements that John made about it shortly coming to pass indicates that such a thing could be so, that it describes what might be thought of as three kinds of rule, and that is the pagan and imperial and papal rule of Rome. This kind of thing involved. Oh, the number 666, that's in verse 18 of chapter 13. That's one that they all, this 666 applies to everybody, depending on who reads it, and who's worked out his figures on that. The New Testament, so far as we're able to determine, was, maybe with the exception of one book, and that's the book of Matthew, was written in the Greek language. The Greeks had a numerical system using their letters of the alphabet, just as the Romans had one. But you can understand it's different from the Roman system, numeral system, which we had to study in school. The Greeks had a system. And men have figured it out and have declared, as they read the numeral system of the Greeks, that the word Latinus, L-A-T-E-I-N-O-S, has the right number in it for 666. And thus that it applies unto Rome that we've been talking about and its government. I'm not even going to try to tell you that it does. Now, if you talk with a Roman Catholic about it, and he's ever thought about it, he won't tell you that that's what it applies to. He'll want to tell you, perhaps, that it applies unto the Muslims. That that's what it is talking about. And he'll have his number system, and thus everybody has his own number system as to what is involved in that. Then chapter 16 and verse 16. Armageddon. Oh, everybody's got their Armageddon. This sign or this symbol that is thus described as Armageddon really is talking about conflict. They were having conflicts then when John was writing the letter. And the word Armageddon is actually derived from the name and the use of the name in 2 Chronicles chapter 35 and verse 22. This is the time when Pharaoh Necho went out from Egypt going over to fight the Assyrians. And he was passing through some of the Judah territory. And so Josiah, the king of Judah, went out to meet Pharaoh Necho and fought his battle in the valley of Megiddo and suffered a great defeat. There had been a battle before that fought by the Israelites. I believe it was against the Midianites in Megiddo. No, the Canaanites. The Canaanites. Just said the Canaanites in Megiddo. But then this word, Armageddon, the R in front of it, between, spelled in some versions higher because the A in the language has the rough sound, and that's the reason why you have the H before it, means mountain. The mountain of Megiddo. And the valley of Megiddo, where Josiah fought his battle, came down from between two mounts into the valley of Esdraelon, which extended from just above Carmel right down to the Jordan River. And this is just a little valley with a little stream that leads into, what is that river, Kishon? That's in Esdraelon Valley, that goes into the river. And yet people will have the literal impression, notice what I say, they'll get the impression that there is where the Lord, when he comes again, great battle with the beast, the man of sin, that Swaggart was talking about this morning, in that valley, or on the mount of Megiddo, Armageddon. And the army of Israel and the army of Syria today, that those two armies couldn't get in the valley of Megiddo and would overrun the mount from which it comes. They couldn't get in it, and yet they have that kind of a literal interpretation of this conflict in Megiddo. It's actually just talking about conflict and using that as figure is what is involved in it. From the historical view that those Christians would know when they knew the Old Testament history and use of the word. And I was going to talk about the thousand-year reign of Revelation 20. And I knew this had happened because I didn't say this speech over. I found out I never could say one and make it come out. So I just quit trying to come out in time. But once again, verse 1 talks about this being a sign. It's a vision that John sees. And thus, it is figurative in its application. We must recognize that even from the very terms that he uses to begin the discussion. He says he saw this. Now, nearly every one of these people will recognize and admit that there are things that are symbolic, that are but signs and not literal in the passage. They'll say that the bottomless pit is really not a literal thing, but that it signifies some great and deep, inescapable thing. Now that's maybe the kind of words that they'd use in describing, they would have big ones to use on. And then talks about a chain. And that chain, and the book that Gary mentioned, the man in that book began to talk about that chain in his debate on this, and that represented some power, signified some power that Jesus and his saints would have over Satan. And thus, what is he saying? Well, he's saying it's not all literal. But when he comes to 1,000 years in there, that has to be literal. But he'll take any number of things in the same passage and make them figurative. Oh, they'll take the serpent. The old serpent, the devil. Well, that's just figurative. They'll agree with you that that's figurative. And then, when it comes to the matter of the souls that are beheaded, well, once again, that to them is figurative because they're talking about people who have been raised with their bodies. That's figurative to them as well. These are just a few of the things in there that they accept as figurative. Well, why can't they realize that the passage is figurative? That the passage is symbolic and not a literal accomplishment, not a literal thing. Actually, the passage is a sequel to chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. And a thing or two, let me call to your attention, as we look at that. Actually, those in the first resurrection, now this is Revelation 20, I'm back there in that passage. Those who rose there are rising to reign, that is right, which is the first resurrection. But from where is it rising in chapter 6 emphasizes what it is. As those who are underneath the altar, who've been slain for the word of God, that's what those are in chapter 20 of Revelation, they're slain. And then he says, and for the testimony which they held, and they cried with a great voice, saying, How long, O Master, the holy and the true, dost thou judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And there was given them to each one a white robe, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little time, until their fellow servants also and their brethren, who should be killed even as they were, should have fulfilled their course. Now, Revelation chapter 20 does not say how long Christ reigns. Now, I'm not even considering 1,000 years literal, but it doesn't even say how long Christ reigns with that term either. But that's the souls who reign with Christ 1,000 years. Not how long Christ reigns. You can read in the text of the New Testament how long Christ reigns, that he ascended to the right hand of God to begin his reign, that he's reigning at God's right hand, and that when he comes and the judgment takes place, he'll deliver the kingdom to God the Father, 1 Corinthians 15. So we know how long Christ reigns, not in number of years, but we know what the beginning is and what the ending is. Now then, this 1,000-year reign is somewhere in within that limitation, whether you think of it literal or not literal, because they reign with Christ. And as Christ, he is reigning. Now then, there's another point about this. And that is that those who have been beheaded for the cause of Christ are those who have been faithful unto death, Revelation 2 and 10. They've been faithful unto death. If not really talking about, in that passage, faithful until death, until means as long as you live. But this is faithful to the point of dying for the cause, unto death. That's what's involved in it. And that's the very one that is described in both chapter 6 and in chapter 20. And, again, he talks about the second death over there in chapter 20. And that would be compared, now, the second death is compared to the first death or martyrdom of these saints. Now we can see what is involved in that. Over these, the second death hath no power, he says, over those who have died, who've been faithful unto death. Second death hath no power over them. And then, the 1,000 years in that passage, is Revelation 20, is compared to the little time of Revelation chapter 6. He talks about the little time. And here, the 1,000 years is the way he describes it. And the point is that it is a reign of victorious righteousness. And this is the kind of thing Royce was talking about when he's talking about the thing that is encouraging in the book of Revelation. That there is a victory of righteousness involved in that. Some people have the impression, I'm going to talk about that too now, you just hold on, Gary, have the impression that this first resurrection is baptism, and that this period here is talking about the persons living here upon the earth as a Christian from that resurrection from baptism. It presents a great difficulty. That idea does. And one man who was presenting that asked for questions like is done here. And I asked the question. I said, well, how do you deal with that in view of the doctrine of the impossibility of apostasy? Because the passage says that those who go through the first resurrection, over them the second death hath no power. And does he keep going to torment if he's gone through the first resurrection? And that first resurrection is baptism. And he said, well, it does present difficulty, doesn't it? And that's the plank under the water that he has. He just answered, it presents a difficulty, and it surely does. And when you find difficulty like that, you just know that something must be wrong about it. And besides that, it doesn't at all fit the idea of souls beheaded. After all, when I was baptized into Christ, I wasn't beheaded. And yet this is a picture of souls beheaded. Reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. There's no end to this, and I just quit.